This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we present a special on animal rights in the United States. Our guests from People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals discuss several court cases aimed at ending the suffering of animals in research labs, roadside zoos, the entertainment industry, and other areas. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Each year, December 10th marks International Animal Rights Day to draw attention to the prevalent use and abuse of non-human animals. It coincides with Human Rights Day, when the United Nations General Assembly adopted in 1948 the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Non-human animals are sentient. That means they have a capacity to experience feelings, such as happiness, joy, gratitude, as well as pain, suffering, and grief. Animal welfare activists urge society to stop thinking of animals as human property and as companions rather than pets. They urge abstention from all animal use, including meat, leather, milk, wool, and silk, while also calling for an end to experimentation on animals. Other initiatives include seeking an end to using animals for lab experimentation and for sporting events and entertainment. Scientists at People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, or PETA, have written an authoritative report from dozens of studies, some funded by the National Institutes of Health, that show sentience across the animal kingdom. The report concludes that because other animals experience emotions just as humans do, it is unethical to subject them to the trauma and emotional distress of experimentation. Asher Smith is the director of litigation at the PETA Foundation. He has helped secure the rescue of 25 big cats from roadside zoos featured in the Netflix series Tiger King. More recently, Asher has focused on freeing 30 barn owls from a laboratory at Johns Hopkins University.
As we regularly note in our lawsuits, even animals that the public often doesn't think of as such are sentient beings with distinct personalities who can either suffer or thrive. For example, in natural environments, barn owls will mate for life, help each other parent their young, and display empathy. In one field study, for example, scientists observed owl nestlings delaying their own meals so that their hungriest siblings could eat first. It's because all animals can experience joy and pain that the law should treat them as something more than mere property. While Johns Hopkins tells the public that they experiment on owls to understand attention deficit disorders in humans, Johns Hopkins experimenters admit in their grant application they study owls because they think it's easier. They consider owls' brains easy to observe, and in large part because of their own prior work, there's already lots of data on owls. In addition, as I'll explain, there are less legal protections for owls bred in labs. In short, experimenters use owls because they're a convenient way to keep grant money flowing.
In September 2018, NPR published a story about a team of researchers at Johns Hopkins University who were studying barn owls to understand why people with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder have trouble focusing. The feature highlighted the lab of Assistant Professor Shreese Mysore, who is affiliated with the Department of Neuroscience and the Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences. The professor's experiments took place over 6 to 18 months and purportedly sought to understand spatial selection and selective spatial attention.
These experiments are some of the most gruesome taking place today. At an early stage of these owls' confinement, their skulls will be cut open so that experimenters can jam electrodes into their brains. The experimenters performing these surgeries do not need to be qualified. They are often students. These owls will then be painfully confined for up to 12 hours at a time and bombarded with jarring sounds and images while experimenters continue to prod their brains with electrodes. When these owls struggle against their restraints, experimenters may need to reposition electrodes, further mutilating owl brain tissue. Those owls who become too damaged to be of use to experimenters will all be killed. At the end of these experiments, all surviving owls would be killed as well, as if they are nothing more than cheap, disposable instruments. These experiments have gone on for several years. Currently, there's at least 30 owls in this laboratory.
The PETA case, on behalf of these owls, argues that the U.S. Constitution protects them. The theory may surprise some, but it has legal precedent.
A bill of attainder is old-timey language for a specific kind of law common in English history. Bills of attainder were favorite weapons of bloodthirsty English kings. In light of this history, the Constitution's framers chose unanimously and without debate to ban Congress from passing them. That means, by the plain text of the Constitution, these owls have the same protections against these laws as anyone else. In fact, because this lawsuit concerns a loophole to the Federal Animal Welfare Act that will result in these owls suffering and death, these owls are faced with a punishment closer to the concerns of the Constitution's framers than the sorts of regulatory grievances inanimate corporations tend to raise in similar lawsuits today.
The Animal Welfare Act was signed by Lyndon Johnson in 1966 and is the primary federal law in the U.S., regulating the treatment of animals in research and exhibition. Animals covered under the Act include any live or dead cat, dog, hamster, rabbit, non-human primate, guinea pig, and any other warm-blooded animal determined by the Secretary of Agriculture for research, pet use, or exhibition. In 2002, the late Senator Jesse Helms instituted the Helms Amendment to the AWA, removing all protections for birds, rats, and mice bred in labs.
In 2002, Congress passed an amendment to the Animal Welfare Act drafted by Jesse Helms, a notorious segregationist, that banned birds, mice, and rats bred for use in research from coverage. The only discussion of this law in Congress was Senator Helms' own cruel, sarcastic floor speech, where he suggested that these animals might as well be, in his words, food for reptiles. This cruel law banned the government from protecting 99% of the animals used in labs. It's because of the Helms Amendment that labs across the country routinely torture and painfully kill birds, rats, and mice by the tens of millions every year without any need to adhere to Animal Welfare Act standards. If the Animal Welfare Act applied to these animals, these laboratories could not, for example, allow repeated surgeries by inexperienced students, would have to use appropriate pain medication, and would have to consider alternatives to painful experiments.
Some of the worst animal abuse occurs every day as a matter of routine practice in U.S. factory farms and laboratories.
Your listeners might be disturbed to hear, however, that these kinds of investigations are under threat. My colleagues and I are fighting against laws in several states that seek to criminalize undercover investigations in agricultural facilities, which we point out violates the First Amendment. These laws have passed in several states dominated by agricultural interests. The way that these laws, often referred to as ag-gag laws, function is that they criminalize the sorts of undercover investigations that have exposed horrific conditions at these facilities, even facilities that claim to be raising animals humanely. The average consumer at the grocery store would have no idea, for example, that a turkey advertised as humane comes from a facility where they're subject to regular beatings from staff. A consumer also wouldn't know that eggs, meat, poultry from animals advertised as receiving humane treatment are ultimately sold to the same industrial slaughterhouses as animals from factory farms. Factory farms are where essentially all of the animals used for food live their short, torturous lives. Essentially, all animal products consumed by the public and sold at grocery stores today come from enormous facilities in which animal lives and welfare aren't even secondary and considered. Unfortunately, even conditions at agricultural facilities that can't be described as factory farms are all better. For example, me and my colleagues once sued Nelly's Free Range Eggs for advertising showing hens frolicking on green grass and declaring that their hens could peck, perch, and play on that green grass. But what a PETA investigation showed is that Nelly's, despite advertising their eggs as the source of love and kindness, crams 20,000 hens into individual sheds with barely more than 1 square foot of space each, which means that even at this free-range supplier, many hens would never make it to the outdoor space featured so prominently in Nelly's advertising. And after approximately 13 months of laying, those hens will and have been sold to the same slaughterhouses that their factory farm peers end up in. We don't see images of conditions at factory farms and suppliers of animal products because agricultural interests work so hard to prevent the public from seeing them. In states like Iowa, Arkansas, North Carolina, just to name a few, they've succeeded in having legislatures pass laws essentially criminalizing investigation of their facilities.
Consumers spent about $99 billion in 2020 on their companion animals, reflecting a deep-seated love for domesticated dogs and cats. PETA contends that the Animal Welfare Act provides a framework for how we treat all non-human animals, and that it is instructional on how the country should treat all animals, not just popular companion species, in our society.
Americans spend so much on companion animals, but spend so little attention or care on animals, for example, that are used for food, because of what's called speciesism, laws and attitudes that treat animals differently despite their equal capacity to feel joy, pain, or suffering. Our lawsuit on behalf of owls at Johns Hopkins University places speciesism front and center. It challenges a law that treats owls differently from other animals just because they may be more convenient for experimenters. The easiest thing that members of the public can do to help animals is to stop eating them and to stop eating and consuming animal products. Everyone who chooses to go vegan instantly saves at least 200 animals a year. And the fight in the courtroom is only part of the fight to save these animals. For example, PETA's engaged in years of painstaking efforts to rescue these owls at Johns Hopkins University, including a letter-writing campaign that members of the public can participate in if they go to peta.org/owls and call on Johns Hopkins to end these experiments. In the United States, there are some laws that protect animals. One such law is the Endangered Species Act. While PETA seeks to convince courts that animals in laboratories deserve legal protections that the law unfairly denies them, my colleagues and I are currently winning victories that are changing cruel and torturous conditions for animals used for entertainment. Our litigation under the Endangered Species Act against the worst of the worst roadside zoos is establishing that conditions at these facilities is often not only cruel, but illegal. I spent years working on PETA's lawsuit against one of the villains of Tiger King seasons 1 and 2, Tim Stark. Stark ran a notorious facility in Indiana that put on events called Tiger Baby Playtime, featuring declawed lion and tiger cubs. PETA argued in its lawsuit that prematurely tearing big cat cubs from their mothers, declawing them, and exposing them to stressful cub petting events is illegal under the Endangered Species Act. After years of litigation, PETA won an historic victory agreeing with its interpretation of the Endangered Species Act and ordering the surviving big cats transferred to reputable sanctuaries. This victory continues to pay dividends for animals. Shortly thereafter, the federal government sued another Tiger King villain, Jeff Lowe, adopting PETA's legal theories and citing PETA's prior victories, as well as evidence PETA uncovered. Today, there are no more animals at either Starks or Lowe's facilities. Members of the public might also be interested in hearing that I got an update the other day on Nala, one of the lions rescued from Jeff Lowe when she was just a year old. When Lowe and one of his business partners wheeled Nala out of their facility for our team of rescuers, she couldn't walk more than a few steps without falling down. After she finally saw a qualified veterinarian at her new home, she was diagnosed with bone fractures from an inadequate diet. Now, she's recovering and thriving, running and playing in an enormous enclosure with three other lions rescued as part of that same case. States are beginning to pass more laws that protect animals, but these laws include many of the same flaws we see at the federal level. For example, while we applaud states such as New York that are passing laws against practices such as declawing of domestic cats, and states that have strong cruelty to animal protections, these cruelty to animal laws frequently include exemptions for actions that torture animals in laboratories, on factory farms, and in other environments where animals are used for profit.
Roadside zoos, which dot the U.S. landscape, are grossly substandard, typically amateur facilities that lack training, experienced animal care staff, proper funding, and safety practices. Animals there receive inadequate housing, care, and diet.
In PETA's Endangered Species Act lawsuit against the worst of the worst roadside zoos, PETA's tried to set a legal precedent that separation of cubs and mothers when cubs are only a day or two old violates the law. We won a major victory against Tim Stark's Wildlife in Need facility in southern Indiana that establishes that premature separation of cub and mother is a violation of the law. Thanks to this ruling, it's more clear than ever that absent medical necessity, this inflicts lifelong harm on cats. For example, cubs need nutrients, colostrum, and antibodies that only their mother's milk can provide. And as the court made clear in our victory, premature separation can be deadly. Maternal separation is not a one-time injury. It jeopardizes cubs' developing immune systems and can prevent them from adequately defending against disease and parasites for the rest of their lives. Instead of nursing from their mothers and learning behaviors they'll need as adults, cubs torn from their mothers are shoved into dangerous, high-stress environments. In the words of a United States Department of Agriculture official, whose testimony PETA presented to the court in its motion for summary judgment in that case, the appropriate age to separate cubs from their mothers is never, because public interactions are dangerous for the cubs' health, because they've already been stressed by being removed from their mother, and exhausted babies are more prone to become sick, catch viruses or diseases that could have been brought in on hands of people visiting. I've seen these effects firsthand. Watching Leo, the male lion rescued from Jeff Lowe's facility as part of that same lawsuit, compulsively suckling on his sister's ears and tails because he needed his mother. As part of that same case, the court made clear that cubs used for so-called tiger baby playtime cub petting events were subjected to extreme stress, were denied adequate rest, and faced unqualified roadside zoo staff who were taught to train them using negative reinforcement, in some cases, hitting cats with riding crops. When I asked the owner of this facility, Tim Stark, during his deposition whether he believes in negative reinforcement, his answer was that a good old-fashioned ass beating is good for them. And he added, "I whipped my own children when they were young to teach them." These kinds of practices are endemic in the cub petting industry. Declawing by unqualified veterinarians also has been known to occur, and was a measure favored by Tim Stark that the court also declared a violation of the law. There's no way to humanely visit, frequent, or put on cub petting events.
In March 2020, we spoke with attorney Tamara Bedich chairperson of the National Lawyers Guild's Animal Rights Project. Tamara spoke about how U.S. laws compare with other nations and how animal rights activists are portrayed and treated by the FBI and other federal agencies.
I feel that other countries have surpassed us and that we are falling further behind. So, for example, if we compare the status of U.S. animal laws to, for example, the European Union, the thing that jumps out at us immediately is that the European Union laws create a single legal standard across all 26 European Union countries. Here, we have a state-by-state approach. So Maryland and Pennsylvania will restrict canine tail docking, and 9 states will regulate canine ear cropping, but not the others. And New York state laws have banned declawing, etc. It's haphazard. Meanwhile, the European Convention for Pet Protection, Article 3, states, quote, "No one shall cause a pet unnecessary pain, suffering, or distress," close quote, full stop, boom. It covers declawing, tail docking, ear cropping. It covers all that in one fell swoop and across 26 countries. That's the difference. That's where we need to go.
Well, let's talk about the state that we're recording this show in, New York State. I've heard there's movement afoot to introduce laws banning puppy mills, but what laws have we passed already to protect non-human animals?
Well, in New York, you can't leave your dog in a locked car in extreme heat or cold. You can't leave them outside in extreme heat or cold. You can't pierce or tattoo your dog unless it's for identification. You can't declaw your cat anymore. You can't overdrive or overwork your horse. But yet, we had a 12-year-old mare, Aisha, collapsing multiple times in Central Park February 29th. Cockfighting and dogfighting, they're both illegal in New York. Yet, December 6th, 2019, the NYPD busted a dogfighting ring and rescued 30 pit bulls, but Judge Melissa Jackson released all 3 suspects without bail. So we have some very good laws. The enforcement of those laws is still challenging.
Tamara, over the many years that I worked at the National Lawyers Guild, of which you are a member as well, we did a lot of work defending activists in the streets, in the courts. And I know that when I started in 1999, we didn't have many animal rights activists. Fortunately, that has changed over the years. I want to ask you, do you think animal rights and animal welfare activists have gotten a bad reputation in the public arena? And if so, how and why?
Well, America's political process has been usurped and corrupted by enormous corporations who pay off politicians who then write laws that support those donors. And in this framework, idealistic activists with little money or access to political power are shining a light in some of our darkest corners on behalf of sentient creatures with zero money and zero access to political power. Activists are the true underdogs here, but they're vilified by corporate money and by corporate interests.
Stalwart activist and writer who has been on Law and Disorder, Will Potter, who many listeners may remember runs a great website called Green is the New Red, he used to give presentations on how Wall Street, especially in the early 2000s and maybe the late 1990s, corporations, leaders would portray animal rights and environmental activists as terrorists wearing all black, wearing black masks. They had a lot of almost caricature characteristics, and they would go around. Law enforcement and certain corporations would vilify animal rights activists. I want to ask you how you think these activists have raised awareness of and helped advance consciousness about animal welfare, despite these negative portrayals.
There have been a lot of undercover investigations, particularly Mercy for Animals, Direct Action Everywhere. Activists have stepped in to investigate, on behalf of American consumers, I might add, how animals who are condemned to become our food, how those animals are living and what they're eating, and the revolting, unsanitary conditions of their slaughter. Even if you're entirely utilitarian in your approach, hey, I don't want nasty bacteria in my food, you still deserve to know. You deserve to know. Don't you want to know what happened to that product that you're now putting in your mouth? Where has it been? So why is there zero transparency? Why the need to pass draconian laws in state after state that cloak food production in secrecy? Why ag gag laws?
And that means agricultural gagging.
Gag law. Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Ag gag laws, so that listeners know a little bit more about what this means, are ways to criminalize undercover investigators, and that could be an ordinary citizen going into agricultural farms or places where animals are being raised in inhumane conditions or treated improperly, even tortured, to film them, produce videos and evidence to raise public awareness of inhumane conditions.
I think there was one case where a farm, I wish I remembered the name, but a farm actually sued someone who was traveling and who stopped on the road and took a picture of their friend in the car or in front of the car with the farm in the background. So this was considered a violation because the farm was in the background. Of course, it's entirely sealed off.
Tamara addresses the FBI's labeling of animal rights activists as top domestic terrorism threats and passage of the Animal Rights Enterprise Terrorism Act.
The Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act is a federal law passed without an actual vote and signed by President Bush. The real force pushing the bill, however, was the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, ALEC. And ALEC is a conglomerate of corporate interests, private sector representatives, and conservative state legislators. It's headquartered in Arlington, Virginia, and the corporate members of ALEC draft and share legislation, and then they distribute these model bills to their state legislators. So various conservative state legislators don't even have to draft their own legislation. They get the corporations to do it for them.
You know, years ago, many people hadn't heard of ALEC, but now it's received more attention in part because of their advisements, their amicus briefs on criminal justice, all sorts of issues that affect our economy, our laws, and our policies. I actually tried to join ALEC. I went online. I wanted to sort of, you know, monitor, but the fee to join, the membership fee, begins, I think, at $5,000. It was a little too hefty for my budget. Let's talk about the kinds of actions that prosecutors have brought under ADA.
Well, the best-known case was actually brought under the previous law, which was a softer, gentler ADA. It was the Animal Enterprise Protection Act, and it was brought against the Shack 7. The Shack 7 was a group of six animal rights activists, plus their computer, engaged in protected free speech behavior against an animal testing laboratory. And this became a landmark case because it showed how far the government will use terrorism rhetoric to silence free speech. There's a wonderful documentary detailing what happened, and that's Joaquin Phoenix's Animal People. It's available now on YouTube. It came out late last year, so I would recommend it to people. Subsequently, other animal activists have also been prosecuted on the federal level, and AETA was used against them as well, most notably the Johnson case, where Johnson and a companion freed 2,000 minks from a fur farm.
You mentioned six activists and their computer. The Shack 7, or let's say the Shack 6, ran an informational website that gave information about animal rights actions across the country.
That's right. And giving that information was criminalized.
Correct. They didn't actually, as I recall, urge people to attend. They just gave the information.
This is what's happening in so-and-so. This is what so-and-so is doing. Our branch in, you know, Spokane, Washington just did this. Exactly.
Right. And I think it's worth repeating the point that you made a few minutes ago about the government's failure or inability to catch so-called terrorists, that it's been an easy target to go after very vocal members of animal rights and environmental activists, especially when years ago they were, for the most part, unsuccessful in catching people who participated in the so-called underground movements like the Animal Liberation Front, Earth Liberation Front. So prosecutors then pursued lawful activists who were getting media attention and also those who were successful at what they did.
Exactly, like the Shack 7.
Yes.
So these were low-lying fruit, right? I mean,
exactly.
it was easy to get these people indicted and sentenced, and ultimately, you know, these people did time.
Yes, the Shack 7 all did time, and they were high-profile cases. So
right.
I think that serves the government's purpose of making them look successful.
And chilling other people from doing the same thing. This has an incredible chilling effect on people who want to go out and hand out leaflets. Handing out leaflets and chalking on the sidewalk is now criminalized behavior. And it's unfortunate that this is sweeping the country and it's affecting other groups beyond animal rights activists, beyond environmental activists. It's now affecting First Nations, Native Americans, Indigenous people. If you don't want a pipeline spoiling your water, you're facing criminal charges now. You're being criminalized for protesting.
That's a very good point. I'd also want to mention that ADA is drafted so broadly, and really the wording is so unclear. I remember when I was at the Guild, I used to get calls right after it was passed saying, we don't know if what we're doing is going to be criminalized. We need guidance. We need help. And as you say, that creates a chilling effect. People may opt not to go out to the streets and exercise their First Amendment rights for fear they're going to be prosecuted.
With more than 9 million members and supporters worldwide, PETA for the Ethical Treatment of Animals is the largest animal rights organization in the world. Its work encompasses four areas in which animals have suffered the most intensely and for the longest periods of time. They are in research labs, the food industry, the clothing trade, and the entertainment business. PETA conducts public education, investigative news gathering, and reporting, research, animal rescue,
legislation, and protest campaigns. Jared Goodman is PETA Foundation Vice President and Deputy General Counsel for Animal Law. He describes what speciesism is in the United States.
Americans generally, and I think all of us are included here, definitely have a sort of a soft spot in our hearts for the dogs and cats in our home. But that doesn't necessarily extend to other species or, you know, those who aren't. PETA does a great deal of work with even these domesticated animals who unfortunately are subject to abuse very often. And with respect to wild animals, the public is widely opposed to things like hunting, but still we see individuals going to facilities like the Miami Seaquarium or other unaccredited roadside zoos to see these wild animals in conditions that are actually incredibly harmful to them. So while there is generally this sort of appreciation for who these animals are, as we see also through the proliferation of wildlife documentaries, we aren't necessarily doing as much as we can to help these species and actually, to some extent, support them being held in bad conditions by visiting places like this. But, you know, the good thing is that fewer and fewer people are visiting roadside zoos, and places like those featured in The Tiger King are being shut down one after another, and people are losing the opportunity to engage in these harmful interactions with wild animals. So unfortunately, domesticated animals, dogs and cats are abused in many ways, and not only in the most egregious ways that we think of. Of course, there are things like dog fighting, which is just the most horrific abuse. The animals are abused for training. It's incredibly a vicious fight, of course, where the animals are subjected to very severe injury and death. And as we've seen in some very public cases, even when animals are able to survive those fights, if they don't fight well enough, they're killed by the people who are supposed to be their guardians. But harm to domestic animals really extends far beyond that, and it's not always willful. There is a serious overpopulation crisis in this country with dogs and cats. These animals are on the street and suffering immensely. PETA's Community Animal Project does a lot of work in Virginia and North Carolina trying to improve the lives of animals who are living at homes with people who might not know any better or do but don't even have the resources to provide the animals with the care that they need. You know, these animals suffer from emaciation, fly strike, are living outside chained 24/7 in extreme temperatures, hot and cold, and really suffering terribly. So what we really need to do as a society is ensure that we are spaying and neutering animals, stop supporting breeders, and do everything we can to address this crisis.
As we've already discussed, PETA has brought forth many lawsuits aimed at protecting non-domesticated animals. In 2014, an eyewitness investigation of the Missouri Primate Foundation in Festus, Missouri, revealed deplorable and unlawful conditions. The foundation is a decrepit breeding facility and the primary source of chimpanzees sold to the entertainment industry and the exotic pet trade. After PETA broke the investigation, a former volunteer for the facility named Angela Scott contacted PETA to report concerns of abuse and neglect there.
PETA has long been familiar with the Missouri Primate Foundation because it was the primary breeding ground for chimpanzees in the entertainment and exotic pet trade industries. It's a facility that had long been cited by the U.S. Department of Agriculture for violations of the Federal Animal Welfare Act. So in 2014, PETA conducted an undercover investigation of the facility, and a few people went in to be volunteers to assist with cleaning the cages and things like that. Similarly, after this investigation was released, a former longtime volunteer of the facility came to PETA and described conditions that were not only consistent with PETA's investigation, but revealed far more harm and abuse of the animals at the facility. So the lawsuit was brought under the Federal Endangered Species Act, and it was claiming that the animals were denied their fundamental social, physical, and psychological needs. They were confined to a dangerous and unsanitary environment, restricted to a dangerously unhealthy diet, and the facility failed to provide them with adequate preventative and emergency veterinary care. And it alleged that these conditions and the failure to provide these things were a take, harm and harassment under the Endangered Species Act. The case is ongoing. All of the chimpanzees who are remaining at the facility have been moved. The Missouri Primate Foundation is no more. It is no longer a breeding ground for chimpanzees for the exotic pet trade or the entertainment industry. However, we continue to litigate the case in relation to two chimpanzees who were moved from the facility and are being hidden by their owners in violation of court orders. Several of the chimpanzees have been moved already to accredited sanctuaries, which is what we had thought from the very beginning of this case, where they can roam, climb, and swing and have the opportunity to socialize in large groups. In short, just have some semblance of a natural life and receive the care that they need to be able to live as natural life as possible. The chimpanzees who have been sent to sanctuary are Allie, Chloe, Michaela, Connor, Candy, Crystal, Terry, and I might be forgetting one or two, Tammy. And we continue to litigate over both Joey and Tonka. So their situations are a little bit different, and I'm happy to describe them. Joey was a chimpanzee who was being boarded at the Missouri Primate Foundation for several years at the time that PETA filed its lawsuit. He's owned by a man named Andrew Sawyer, who did not live in Missouri, but placed him there and would visit the facility regularly and go in the cage with Joey. Joey was held in solitary confinement there. He had no opportunity to engage in physical contact with other members of his species, even though chimpanzees are highly, highly social. But when PETA sent its statutorily required notice of intent to sue under the Endangered Species Act at the end of 2016, Mr. Sawyer went to the facility, put Joey in his car, and drove away. The last information that we had was that he was held at a facility in Florida owned by Doc Antle, one of the individuals who is shown in the Tiger King series on Netflix, who is actually now facing also cruelty to animals and wildlife trafficking charges in Virginia. But I digress. So the court has entered summary judgment against Sawyer and ordered that Joey be transferred to a sanctuary as well. And that still has not happened. We've notified the court of the continuing violation of the court's order, and will continue to pursue that until Joey is moved to where he belongs. Tonka is a somewhat similar situation. Tonka is a chimpanzee who was at the Missouri Primate Foundation for some time. He was bred there and was used for the entertainment industry. He appeared in movies, including the movie Buddy with Alan Cumming, who is an animal rights advocate, a huge PETA supporter, and actually did a press conference when we filed our claims in this case. So after Alan had worked with Tonka, he had inquired where he was, what was happening with him, and he was told that Tonka was retired, and he assumed that that meant he was sent somewhere beautiful like Palm Springs, where he could really just have the opportunity to relax and be a chimpanzee in an appropriate environment. Little did he know until we told him that that wasn't the case. Tonka ended up at the Missouri Primate Foundation, where he was held in these conditions that failed to meet his needs, that failed to meet even the minimum requirements of the Federal Animal Welfare Act. Tonka was among the chimpanzees who the court ordered be moved to an accredited sanctuary, and all of those other chimpanzees have been moved to that sanctuary except Tonka. When shortly before the chimpanzee's transfer, Tonka's then owner told the press that he died. We have reason to believe that he did not, and we believe that she's lying about this to enable her to keep Tonka when the rest of the chimpanzees left, because she was very reluctantly allowing any of them to be moved to the sanctuary. So this is it's been a bit of a battle for Tonka. The first evidence that was presented by his now owner indicated that he was burned on a fire pit after he died at temperatures less than 200 degrees, something that was just incomprehensible, made no sense whatsoever, impossible. When we informed the court of this and that she had failed to provide evidence of Tonka's death, we received a revised declaration indicating that that was just a typo, and it was temperatures much higher, but still he was burned in a funeral pyre outside, and that there were only ashes remaining, which also, according to the published research, is not simply not what would happen if an animal were cremated in this way. In fact, folks who run crematoriums for non-human animals report that even when a cremation is done appropriately, skeletal remains are there. They might be more brittle than they were before cremation, but additional manual processing has to be done to the bones to get the ashes that you receive when your loved one dies. And that's not what was reflected in the evidence that was submitted by Tonka's owner. So we are continuing to pursue that. We have a hearing scheduled for December 1st on our order to show cause as to why his owner should not be held in contempt for failing to transfer him along with the other chimpanzees to the accredited sanctuary.
PETA also launched a parallel campaign against greeting card companies Hallmark and American Greetings, calling on both to pull all cards featuring chimpanzees. One of the chimpanzees that PETA rescued from the Missouri Primate Foundation, Connor, was used for controversial greeting cards that Hallmark still sells today.
Many people might have seen chimpanzees on greeting cards. Generally, they are dressed up in some sort of outfit, and they're intended to look comical. Chimpanzees usually have a smile on their face. And what consumers don't know is that that smile is actually a fear grimace. These animals don't want to be dressed up and used as props for photographs. In fact, Connor, one of the chimpanzees who is now at the accredited sanctuary from the Missouri Primate Foundation, appears on many of Hallmark's cards that feature chimpanzees. If you see one of these, it is likely Connor. And Connor's last shoot, it's reported that he was forced to work for 8 hours straight, including many wardrobe changes, and he lost it. He started flipping tables, he bit his trainer, and then that was the last time that he was used for greeting cards. So PETA has had a campaign asking for greeting card companies to simply stop using these cards. Not only is it harmful to the individuals, but published research shows that depictions of animals like this is actually harmful to conservation, because when you see a chimpanzee dressed up in unnatural conditions, you assume that the population is doing just fine, and that's why you can engage in conduct like this. But that's, of course, not the case. You know, they are severely endangered. So PETA has been calling on companies to pull these cards. Fortunately, American Greetings promptly pulled cards featuring Connor after we had reached out. However, they have refused to pull all chimpanzee cards, as has Hallmark, the primary company that is using cards that feature Connor's image. So PETA's been asking for you know, these two companies and really all others to stop using chimpanzees and wild animals in these unnatural settings because they are conveying harmful messages to consumers.
In another case, PETA challenged Florida's Seaquarium with keeping of a lone orca, Lolita, in a tank so small that it fails to meet even the plain language of the minimum legal size requirement of the Animal Welfare Act. The tank exposes Lolita to the burning sun and confines her with incompatible animals.
So we are, again, back in the district court after the district court had dismissed our case against the U.S. Department of Agriculture for licensing the Seaquarium, notwithstanding the fact that the conditions in which Lolita is held clearly appear to violate the bare minimum standards of the Animal Welfare Act. We prevailed at the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals and are now back before the district court essentially litigating over the completeness of the administrative record before we move forward to summary judgment. There is no question that we are moving in the direction of animals receiving personhood status under the law and having meaningful protections. We're seeing people increase their level of compassion as they learn more about the manner in which these animals are used and not being incredibly harmful to them. We're setting precedents in the courts, establishing that the psychological suffering of wild animals in captivity is illegal under the Endangered Species Act, that declawing big cats so they could be separated from their mothers and used in photo shoots for tourists to post photos on Instagram is a violation of the Endangered Species Act. And these facilities are closing. There are fewer and fewer places where people can go to engage in this activity because it's unlawful and because people are becoming more sensitive to the impact of their conduct. There are fewer roadside zoos open than there were just 5 years ago, far fewer. We've rescued 170-some-odd big cats from roadside zoos who primarily have shut down. I believe we're down to single-digit bears who are held in concrete pits in this country. So we are making substantial progress towards recognition of animals as persons. You know, regardless of whether or not we are able to achieve that legal status, you know, within the next several years, there's no question that other progress is being made that is resulting in substantial practical benefits for these animals. Just at the end of September of this year, we learned of and highly publicized a U.S. Department of Agriculture inspection report of the Miami Seaquarium, as our case has been pending, and it is by far the most damning inspection report for a marine mammal facility that I have ever seen. The facility was cited for feeding Lolita and other animals partially rotten fish that had measurable impacts on them, caused her inflammation and other animals to be medicated to prevent further sickness. They refused veterinarian advice to not require Lolita to engage in certain tricks that likely injured her jaw. And they were cited for keeping incompatible dolphins together to the point where they were killing each other. Between 2019 and 2020, just a span of 15 months, two dolphins and a sea lion died of trauma from other individuals in their same tank. After that, other dolphins have been injured from the same conduct. And even at the time of the USDA's inspection in June of this year, the Seaquarium still had no way of keeping track of what animals were put in which tank and when to be able to prevent this conduct from occurring in the future. The circumstances there are really just egregious. And also notably, for the first time, although we have been pursuing this for nearly a decade now, the facility was cited for not providing Lolita with adequate shade. The agency had long bought the Seaquarium's argument that the stadium seating surrounding her tank for the benefit of the public provided her with shade, but it had no shadows cast in the tank when the sun was highest in the sky and strongest and had the strongest UV rays to burn her skin and injure her eyes. And now, again, after nearly a decade, they were cited for this conduct. So we're hopeful that this is also a new direction for the USDA, where they will start taking action to help captive marine mammals.
That was Jared Goodman, Vice President and Deputy General Counsel for Animal Law from PETA. We also heard from Asher Smith, Litigation Manager for the PETA Foundation, and part of an earlier broadcast with Tamara Bedich from the National Lawyers Guild.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org. Thank you.